This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
WGLT crunches the numbers and finds tens of millions of dollars in trade relief payments flowing into central Illinois farms.
The administration says that let's make America great again. I don't think this is making America great. I really don't.
McLean County farmer Wes Kingdon talks about surviving the trade dispute with China. Plus, the Illinois Politics Roundtable looks at the first 100 days of Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot's term, and the latest in the West Market Street Council's efforts to bring a grocery store to West Bloomington. All that after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The trade dispute with China has rocked the American farm economy. And to help soften the blow, the Trump administration has sent billions of dollars of taxpayer money to farmers. This week on Sound Ideas, you'll hear how those relief payments are playing out in central Illinois. And you'll learn why McLean County has received the most money so far for any county in the U.S. and why the next round of payments could be even bigger. Our series begins with Wes Kingdon. He remembers when farming was fun back in the 1970s, when he had enough cash to build his home, stockpiled 3 years of soybeans simply because he didn't need the money. Now the 73-year-old from Gridley is worried, in large part because there's no end in sight for the China trade dispute that's decimated a key market for U.S. soybeans.
Some nights you don't sleep because you lay up there in bed and think about how you're going to make things work or how you're going to get things planted.
There's been some relief. The USDA has already sent $1.1 billion in trade relief payments to Illinois farmers, with billions more on the way. It's going to farmers like Kingdon, who feels the Trump administration has clobbered farmers like him. He says it's like they're being picked on.
It's hurting a lot of people in our country. I guess I wonder, the administration says that let's make America great again. I don't think this is making America great. I really don't.
McLean County farmers have already received $33 million in the first round of trade relief payments. It's formally called the Market Facilitation Program. That's according to a WGLT and WCBU analysis of USDA data. Central Illinois farmers say the payments haven't made them rich, but they've helped. Most of all, the payments have bought their patience as President Donald Trump tries to reach a long-term trade deal with China as he seeks re-election in 2020. But even that patience is starting to strain. Kingdon says he doesn't know why the Trump administration is not working harder at the negotiating table.
I mean, really, our country can't afford to pay its farmers that money. We're so much in debt. I think I seen the other day we're more in debt now than we ever been. So why are we giving the farmers money? Let's get things settled. Let's get our deficit down so to keep growing.
Over 76,000 farmers, farm partnerships, and other ag businesses in Illinois have split the $1.1 billion in payments that have arrived between September of last year and May. USDA data shows that in McLean County, that $33 million went to around 2,000 recipients. McLean County's big haul is not necessarily surprising. We've got some of the most productive farmland in the country, and a lot of it. McLean County farmers produce more than $450 million in grain and livestock each year. That's $320,000 per farm on average. That's the most of any county in Illinois. In McLean County, all but one of the top 10 recipients of USDA payments were farm businesses, often family partnerships, not individual farmers. The biggest recipient was Special K Hog Farm based in Chenoa. That's owned by the Coons family. They received $426,000. The Coons family did not respond to requests for comment for this story. Here's how the payment amounts are determined. Unlike in 2018, when the amounts were set for each commodity, the 2019 payments were based on a flat dollar amount for each county. McLean County's rate of $82 per acre is among the highest in the state. And the average size of a McLean County farm is about 400 acres. That means a payment of over $35,000. And that's just for commodities like corn and beans. Hog farmers would get $11 per head as well. McLean County Farm Bureau President Mark Hines says the soybean payments for 2018 were pretty sizable, and most farmers we interviewed said they were generally pleased with the amounts they received.
I think people were surprised at the size of it. I think it was maybe a little bit bigger than what was expected.
Critics say too much money is going to the biggest, richest farmers. Ann Weir-Schetchinger is a senior economic analyst at the Environmental Working Group, a nonprofit that's been critical of past farm subsidies and now the Market Facilitation Program. She says the top 10% of recipients got over half of the first $8 billion that's been distributed.
So the smaller farms that are really struggling in the wake of Trump's tariffs are not the ones getting the most of these payments. You know, the majority of the payments are going to these big farms.
She says the Environmental Working Group would rather see taxpayer dollars spent on conservation efforts such as cover crops and the popular but underfunded federal conservation easement program.
This money that's going to farm subsidies could really do a lot of good work for the environment if we were channeling it into these different conservation programs.
The government has set aside $14.5 billion in USDA payments for this round. Here's Scott Irwin, an agricultural economist at the University of Illinois.
To the average person, that strikes them as a lot of money, and it is. But it's not making farmers wealthy right now.
Farmers say one reason is that expenses are always going up. Wes Kingdon, that farmer you heard from at the beginning of this story, his combine caught fire 2 years ago. He had to replace it. Those cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I mean, yes, they're large payments to some farm operations, and it may help some make some money. But with the level of prices that we've had in recent years, particularly for soybeans, a better description is it's really on average just helping farmers keep their heads above water, and that's about it.
Payments from 2018 were capped at $125,000 per person. That's going to double this year. But someone both growing corn and beans and producing hogs could get double that. That's what Chad Lehman did. The third-generation farmer was among the top five largest recipients of payments in Woodford County, where he runs a hog production farm and also grows corn and beans. With a wet planting season and the African swine fever stressing out hog farmers, Lehman says the payments have been very helpful. But like other farmers, Lehman says he'd much rather see a long-term trade deal reached with China and the payments go away.
No, it hasn't made us whole. And frankly, I don't expect them to make us whole. I would rather them continue to aggressively pursue this deal. I think that this administration is pursuing a deal that could benefit us far greater in the long term, and so I'm willing to not be made whole in the meantime as long as we've got that fruit dangling out there.
Brett Haas farms corn and beans with his dad Brian and grandfather Dick in southern McLean and northern DeWitt counties. They got the maximum payment for the 2018 program. Haas has just applied for his 2019 payments last week and said the process was really smooth.
By trade, we're not ones for handouts or welfare, if you want to call it that. You know, all that being said, I know there's a lot of reasons that economically are leading up to why this market facilitation program is even there, and times are tight in the ag industry, and there are a lot of things that are out of our control. So it has definitely helped.
So what is the right amount for a Central Illinois farmer to receive? There's no easy answer. Last year's aid package probably overpaid farmers for their trade-related losses, especially soybeans. That's according to a recent analysis from the University of Missouri. But the counterargument is, even if the USDA did overpay on soybeans, it underpaid on corn, which earned farmers just a penny per bushel. Matt Perdue is Government Relations Director at the National Farmers Union. He says the payments just haven't been equitable.
Folks who had a larger share of corn than soybeans on their operation and a lot of these corn and beans operations, they really felt like they got burned by the program, where you had such a low payment for, you know, a penny a bushel for corn.
Economist Scott Irwin says it's not easy to find the right number.
So it's a question of what's the right measure of the damage from the tariffs, the initial price drop or the price drop after everybody has readjusted. And there's good arguments on both ways. So I don't think that there is really truly a simple answer to our farmers being overpaid for the trade losses with China right now.
Regardless, the USDA's formula for 2019 payments is completely different, moving to those county-wide rates of between $15 and $150 per acre. Again, McLean County's rate is $82 per acre. Matt Perdue says it's hard to tell if those county-wide rates are fair because the USDA has released very little information about the math behind them.
We don't have any idea how these individual county payment rates were determined, and so it's really hard to evaluate really the rationale behind it.
Farmers say they're putting the money to good use. Brett Haas, who farms with his dad and grandfather, says they're using it to pay down debt, build up their working capital. Ditto for Dennis Wentworth, whose operation has farmed corn and beans in McLean County for 45 years. He says they're also using the money for operating expenses.
That money is being spent in the local communities, and certainly the money that we receive, it's going to be spent either in fertilizer, chemicals, hiring people, paying employees, and employees are going to use that money to buy food, clothing, and shelter in the communities. That's one thing you can count on. If farmers receive income and receive that payment, they're going to spend it.
But Wentworth is not building the money into his farm's budget. If he gets it again in 2019, great.
Until I see that money in the bank, I'm not counting on it.
Chad Lehman, the hog producer from Woodford County, says what the money has really bought is patience from U.S. farmers as the Trump administration works on long-term trade deals. Indeed, a recent Purdue University survey of 400 farmers found that 78% still believe the trade dispute with China will ultimately be resolved in a way that benefits U.S. agriculture. Lehman explained his thinking during an interview at his office, where a Trump 2020 hat sits on a nearby shelf.
These are complicated deals, and there's, you know, as you and I talk, there's more than ag at the table. And so I think it's been a good faith effort by the administration to buy some time in working through these.
But do trade relief payments also lessen the urgency to solve the China trade dispute? Lehman doesn't think so.
I would be very surprised if they don't feel a sense of urgency in completing this. I would be shocked. When you look at the politics of this and what states carried this election and then the next one not too far around the bend, you're going to need the Iowas and you're going to need the Missouris and the Wisconsins again.
Lehman says farmers are used to being at the mercy of somebody else. It's usually the markets. They're price takers, not price makers.
Right now, we're at the mercy of the negotiators.
You can see interactive graphics showing the top county recipients of USDA payments in Illinois, as well as the top recipients here in McLean County at WGLT.org. This was the first in a four-part series this week about how trade relief payments are playing out in central Illinois. Coming up tomorrow, the politics at play behind the payments. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for WGLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The state of Chicago has a big impact on the state of Illinois, from its financial challenges to its economic output. In this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable, host Sean Crawford leads a discussion about Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot's first 100 days in office and her State of the City address. He's joined in studio by NPR Illinois Springfield Bureau Chief Brian Mackey and Daily Line Chicago Managing Editor Heather Sharon, who kicks things off.
Well, the city has an $838 million budget deficit, and if you think that sounds rather large, you would be correct. It is the largest budget deficit in the city's recent history. And by way of comparison, when Mayor Rahm Emanuel took office in 2011, he had to cope with a $636 million budget deficit. So Lightfoot's problems are about 32% worse.
This was on television. This was quite a big event last night for her. Did she take advantage of that opportunity to really lay things out for everybody?
You know, her speech was about 20, 25 minutes, and it was long on goals and guiding principles and somewhat short on specifics. Now, she will give another budget focus address on October 16th to City Council, and that's the day where she will present her detailed plans. So I assume that she's waiting to detail exactly how she proposes to bridge the gap until that date. However, she floated a number of possible solutions to it, but warned that none of them were going to be easy or painless.
So what have been some of the reviews we've heard so far about the speech? And I guess from you, we heard that there wasn't a lot of detail attached to it. So is that what other people are saying as well?
Indeed. And, you know, the most vociferous criticism has come from the left. She did not propose a really broad increase of tax revenue from progressive sources. So, for example, we've heard aldermen from the left urging that the LaSalle Street tax, essentially a tax on financial services, she has all but ruled that out. They'd also proposed reinstituting the head tax, so basically large Chicago firms would pay a per employee tax to the city. She said that she wasn't ruling anything out, but she certainly didn't include that in her list of potential solutions. She did say that she would be guided by two principles. One, that she would not balance the budget on the backs of Chicago's poorest residents, nor would she take steps that she thought would harm businesses and encourage them to leave the city. That leaves her a very narrow path to get to an approved budget, which of course is typically approved by Thanksgiving or thereabouts and takes effect January 1st.
Heather, so I'm here in the Capitol building in Springfield, and we saw Mayor Lightfoot during the legislative session. I think she was still mayor-elect at that point. And
correct.
She got good reviews, bipartisan good reviews, for saying she wanted to work with lawmakers. And since then, I think we've heard her say that a lot of her agenda still has to pass through Springfield. That's certainly true of the Chicago casino that was approved but seems to have a lot of problems in place with that. Is that still what she's saying, that she still needs the help of Springfield and cities need to work together, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. She emphasized the need for the city to have a casino. That money is earmarked for Chicago's police and fire pensions, so that could help pay down that bill, which is coming due this year to the tune of about $280 million for all four of the city's pension funds. However, you know as well as I do that it was touch and go to get that gaming casino expansion bill through the General Assembly in the waning hours of the session. So I'm not sure that there's a real appetite amongst all legislators to reopen that and potentially sort of cause that Christmas tree to come crashing down one way or the other. The other issue is, as the mayor indicated, she would ask Springfield for permission to raise the real estate transfer tax, which of course you pay when you sell a property, and she wants a graduated tax so that high value properties over $1 million pay a greater share of that sale to the city. That would also need Springfield's approval. She also floated the idea of a congestion fee, and it's not quite clear if she means targeting suburbanites who commute into the city, or sort of if you drive into the central business district, you would pay an additional fee. That would also need approval by Springfield. And those are big lifts to ask of lawmakers who will come back in October for a veto session. But I believe many of them thought they had already taken the tough votes by approving a ballot question that would change the state's income tax to a graduated system rather than a flat tax, as well as a host of other issues on abortion and gaming, as I mentioned, and any number of different things. So she will have to work hard, as the governor said in a statement last night, to sort of build that coalition if she's going to get those things through.
And of course, we've seen the Republicans use, Heather, that graduated income tax you mentioned as the sort of centerpiece of their campaign against Democrats. A lot of people think it's going to be sort of an uphill year for Republicans, with President Trump not very popular in Illinois, statewide at least. And they have made this graduated income tax the centerpiece of their opposition. I'm sure they would be happy to have Democratic lawmakers doing even more things that would put different taxes on people, even if they are in Chicago.
Correct. And a Chicago bailout is always, it can be a tough lift for lawmakers, because if you're from Rockford or Effingham, it's difficult to say, well, we're going to change the rules from Chicago, especially at a time where there seems to be an exacerbated divide between downstate and Chicago. So that's just going to make Lori Lightfoot's life more complicated in the next several weeks.
Heather, you talked about the reviews of this speech, at least, and some of the challenges that face the relatively new mayor at this point. Is it safe to say that the honeymoon might be over for her? The reality of trying to govern is actually starting to kick in?
Oh, certainly. She ticked off what she considers the accomplishments of her first 100 days, which ended this week. And she listed pushing through a package of ethics reforms targeted at the members of the city council, as well as ending aldermanic prerogative, which severely limits the ability of aldermen to have the final say in their wards and turns them into more traditional legislators as opposed to little mayors of their wards. However, she's done that, and now she's going to turn around and potentially ask aldermen to take some very difficult and potentially unpopular votes. So that is tough, and especially as aldermen are looking ahead to their political future and wondering whether this is, really in their best interest or in their residents' best interest. So she's got quite a rock and a hard place that she finds herself between.
That's Daily Line Chicago Managing Editor Heather Sharone, joined on this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable by Brian Mackey, moderated by host Sean Crawford. This is Sound Ideas.
Partnering with WGLT works for CertaPro Painters.
I appreciate everything that WGLT does in the community, and I want to help support that. GLT was just, that was a no-brainer for us.
Mark Mulick with CertaPro, a new WGLT underwriter.
So we're going after the decision makers, the people that want to be up to date with current events and all that kind of stuff.
Partnering with WGLT works for CertaPro Painters. Find out how it can work for you at WGLT.org.
WGLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State now offers a McLean County full tuition scholarship competition. Every student from McLean County entering will receive a one-time $500 scholarship, while five will receive full tuition for 4 years. More at illinoisstate.edu/McLean. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Author Terry Pratchett once wrote, "No one is actually dead until the ripples they cause in the world die away." This story is about the first of those ripples, when people find out about the death of a loved one. The coroner is the last person you want to see knocking at your door. Coroners say telling people someone close to them has died is easily the hardest part of the job. Yet it's often overlooked, and there's no standardized training for it. In this encore story, WGLT's Eric Stock reports on how coroners in central Illinois do this part of their job.
Death does not at first make sense to the minds of those left behind. Time and self-understanding alleviate suffering, but the pain of human loss is universal. Coroners see that truth every day at the first raw moments of the people they have to tell that their someone has died. Peoria County Coroner Jamie Harwood says he was dreading a visit he was about to have with a mother he knew. A year earlier, Harwood had informed the woman her son had died in a car accident. Early one morning late last year, he was back at her door after another son died.
It was just a heavier doom that I felt, that I had to do the same thing again to the same family. And it was devastating. It was absolutely devastating. They knew when they saw me knocking on the door, they knew why I was there at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Harwood had a career in nursing before becoming Peoria County Coroner in 2016. He also has a background in critical care. Even for someone who handles death for a living, Harwood calls that one of the worst days of his career.
It was worse because I was there again, and then they knew why I was there, and so I think they just carried the first tragedy into the second one.
Death notifications are a part of the job for coroners. Tim Russman has been coroner in Woodford County for 25 years and counting. When he gets word of a death and he must tell the family, Russman goes through a mental checklist before heading out.
Every time when I'm on my way, I start thinking, okay, how am I going to open this conversation? What am I going to say? What are the facts? Is this a case that potentially we need to approach his family about maybe being an organ or tissue donor? Those are things that always have to, you want to know. So I kind of rehearse it in my mind, if you will, before I get there.
Russman says you never know how the family member will react to being told their loved one is gone.
It doesn't always go that way, of course, but there's certain key elements of notifying of the death that you do want to hit on.
Most coroners go in twos. They bring along a deputy or someone from law enforcement or clergy for backup and additional support for the family and the coroner. Jamie Harwood reminds himself to always speak with the victim's family at eye level. He says you can't soften the message with euphemisms.
You have to say words like, John Smith has died. Your daughter, Joan Jones, has passed away or has died. You have to use words that really bring truth to the matter as opposed to some facade that they could, lead to believe something different than other than what has truly happened.
And you can be direct while also showing empathy to help someone realize they are not alone. That's according to Livingston County Coroner Danny Watson.
To every person, the death thing is a very personal thing, and they think that nobody really knows how they feel. And that's probably true. But I can still empathize in what they're going through because I've been through it multiple times.
Watson says he was orphaned at age 13, and except for his sister, his family is gone. Ultimately, coroners say it's critical to show compassion in whatever way possible.
I do hug. I'm a hugger.
Kathy Yoder has been the McLean County coroner since 2014 after a two-decade career in nursing. Yoder says her knack for caring for others goes all the way back to grade school as a hospital volunteer at what is now Advocate Broman Medical Center in Normal.
I remember doing that when it was Broca, and I was a little candy striper, and I think it was seventh grade as a little volunteer, and I'd pass waters around, and I thought that was great, and all my little Halloween costumes as a little girl was a nurse. And I took care of my dollies, and that's what I did, and I couldn't think of any other way, and I wanted to take care of others.
Now that means taking care of people after someone they love is gone. Yoder says her office is the voice for those who no longer have one by helping families process everything that must be done after a loved one's death, including organ donation, the autopsy, and funeral arrangements. Most death notifications happen in person. Yoder says in rare cases, she is said to notify family by phone if they don't have close relatives nearby or her office does not know where they live. She says those cases are often tragic in their own way.
The ones over the phone have a tendency to may have known that it was coming. Or if it's an older person, sometimes they haven't had contact with the decedent in years.
Yoder also has some help few coroners have when comforting grieving families. He's not a deputy coroner, but this chaplain has witnessed his share of tragedy.
I guess I approached Kathy and I interviewed for a job position that didn't even exist.
That's Stuart Blade. He was a veteran Bloomington firefighter. He says he felt called to help other families grieve.
If we can provide one area that just provides a little comfort in a process of what's going on for that family, that's an amazing thing that we get to do.
Blade knows something of heartbreak. 6 years ago, he and his wife lost their daughter, Hope, to a birth defect 7 hours after she was born. They have four other children. About 4.5 years ago, Blade talked with Yoder about becoming a coroner's office chaplain. Yoder gave it some thought, and then weeks later came one of the biggest tragedies in Bloomington Normal history. A plane crash in April of 2015 near Bloomington killed seven well-known men on their way back from an NCAA basketball championship game. They're referred to as the Redbird Seven for their ties to Illinois State University. Blade was working with the Bloomington Fire Department unit that arrived on scene that morning looking for the plane through the heavy fog.
Just the amount of notifications that they had to make that morning, going from home to home and visiting seven homes. Kathy called me that day, and it was April 7th that day that it was just like, hey, this is happening. Like, we're moving forward. And that was the day that I was brought onto the team.
Yoder says even though she had trained for mass casualty event, nothing prepares you for the physical, mental, and emotional burden of the real thing and helping the families of the survivors cope.
That went on for a long time, and then it's all about them. It's not about me. But I do know that those were long days, and trying to give 100% to the families, if not more, and that took an emotional toll on everybody involved that I'll never forget it.
A month after that incident, Blade became an ordained minister. Earlier this year, he took his calling a step further and left the fire department to join Eastview Christian Church in Normal, where he is the associate pastor of small groups. In his role as Corner's chaplain, Blade says it's less about talking than it is about listening.
I'm not a therapist, but you are trained in the art of just being quiet, and I think that there's a lot of value in that.
Blade says he likes to get people talking about favorite memories of their just-departed loved one.
I think that's one of my favorite moments of doing this, where you get to, not to just see their, but just see that they're, what a great lifetime we had together, or these are the great moments, and don't forget those moments.
Blade says he's careful not to lead with his faith, partly because you don't know what religion a person does or doesn't have.
I still don't hesitate to ask the question, can I pray for you? But then I enjoy reading, and some of the books that I've read are just different cultural, finding out, what does it look like when somebody of a different faith, what is the process that they take when somebody of that faith passes away?
Blade says another reason to steer clear of mingling church and state is that he is a county employee. Woodford County Coroner Tim Rustman says technology has made death notification more difficult in recent years. Sometimes the family finds out in other ways, maybe through a social media post or an online photo of a crash scene. Rustman says that puts additional pressure on coroner's staff to get to the family first.
It feels like you're almost under the gun now, where you have to, once there's a motor vehicle accident, let's say, you need to really, make sure that you get to that home and get that family notified, because people may drive by with a cell phone and inadvertently take a picture, do something, and next thing a family member is seen on Facebook.
A change in state law several years ago allows coroners to determine a cause of death on their own without having to convene a citizen jury. Rustman says inquests often forced grieving families to relive a tragedy and delayed death benefits and closure.
Some of these counties were being inundated with motor vehicle accidents, let's say, and it would take 2 to 3 months before they could get their inquest set, get their jurors called in. And that whole time, the family did not have copies of that death certificate. And that puts a young mother that lost her husband and has 3 children, she needs those death certificates immediately to get on with her business.
Coroners try to become one with the grieving family, although that takes an emotional toll over time. McLean County handled more than 1,300 deaths last year, nearly 4 per day. Kathy Yoder says about 1 in 5 deaths required an investigation. Coroners also need someone to help them cope.
I have a great husband. How about that?
Yoder is married to Bill Yoder, a circuit judge in McLean County.
Well, the one good thing is he understands my job, and he understands what I do. So the dialogue is wonderful there. He's very supportive, and I'm also supportive of his career. So I think that is actually a great working relationship.
Tim Russman in Woodford County says he too looks to family for comfort when he can.
I give my kids extra hugs sometimes. I remember shortly after my wife died of a brain tumor, my very first coroner's call was a young man that died of a brain tumor, and I thought, how lucky is that?
Russman says separating public life from private is difficult when his small town community has known him as the bearer of bad news for so long.
Probably the most difficult thing for me is I've done this for so long. If I will call someone on the telephone, or when my dad was running for a political office, I would knock on a person's door and say, "Hi, I'm Tim Rustman," and this look on their face would just be like, "Oh no, what's he going to tell us?" So it's not always, I don't always bring bad news.
There is an upside as well to being a small community coroner. Livingston County's Danny Watson lives in Flanagan, population 1,000. Watson says not being a stranger has helped.
Since most people know me somewhat, that it makes things a little easier. Rather than a total stranger, they know who's coming to the door, and they know why.
Peoria County Coroner Jamie Harwood says he learned long ago you can't dwell on the job.
In the moment, emotionally, physically, and compassionately, but when I leave that moment, I leave the moment. I don't carry that moment with me through the rest of my day. My training in nursing has really taught me that there's another family waiting, maybe in another room, maybe in another, you know, another place that they're going to need you.
Harwood says it's important to convey compassion not only to grieving families, but sometimes to the community as a whole. Peoria County has had several notable deaths in recent months, including the state's attorney and the county clerk. The style of public death announcements differs from coroner to coroner. Some simply try to dryly report facts. Harwood tends to show artistic flair. He sometimes posts phrases on social media like, "It is with a heavy heart that we report someone's passing, and I'm deeply saddened to announce someone's passing." Harwood says it seems like the right thing to do when a community is in mourning.
I'd like to think that the public deserves the information that I give them. And sometimes I have to refrain from writing their obituary, you know what I mean? But I want people to know that they're important and that they have families.
Harwood says that's a style he developed on his own.
The funny thing is when you become coroner, they don't give you a media relations class. You don't get templates on how to send out releases or anything like that. So a lot of it has been a growth experience for me.
In fact, there is no real death notification training for coroners at all. Many have on-the-job experience from previous careers in medicine or funeral homes. But elected coroners in Illinois and most states don't have to have training or certification. Woodford County Coroner Tim Russman is a funeral director. He says the soft skills are something a coroner simply has to have.
There is a system there, that, you know, the electoral system. If you have a coroner that obviously can't perform the duties, they're not going to be around very long. So, you know, it's the technical side of things can be taught. You can go to classes, you can go to seminars, you can learn that. The empathy and the compassion part, I think, is God-given. You just are either born with it or you're not.
Russman says it can be hard to process the never-ending cycle of grief coroners face, though he takes comfort in making sure grieving families know where they can turn for help.
I see a lot of these departments do debriefings, de-stressings, things like that. You hear a lot about PTSD. I don't know. I have learned over the years to put a positive spin on it as I am really helping these people at the worst time of their life.
Most coroners, including McLean County's Kathy Yoder, says the job reinforces the truth that time is precious.
You never know when your last day is your last day, so enjoy your life, enjoy your family, love your friends, because you never know, but you can't worry about that.
Empathy also does not stop with the fact of the death. Coroners are resource centers for grief pamphlets, places of worship, and just being available to them 24/7. Coroners say help for grieving families can go on for weeks or months after a death. I'm Eric Stock.
Cook County is the only county in Illinois that does not have a coroner. It has a medical examiner, which the county appoints. This is Sound Ideas. The group looking to bring a much-needed grocery store to Bloomington's West Side has reached a major milestone. The West Market Street Council says it's reached an agreement to buy the shopping plaza it's been targeting for the project. They've got 1 year to put together the financing to buy it. In this encore interview, West Market Street Council Project Coordinator Lori Bell tells WGLT's Charlie Schlenker about their efforts to water the West Bloomington food desert.
But it's a plaza that remains mostly blight, with only one retail location there, which is Rosie's Mexican Grill. And we want to buy that piece of property, and we want to redevelop it into a full plaza and locate the West Bloomington grocery store there.
How extensive is the food desert there?
It is quite extensive. There is no grocery store between Kroger's on Main Street and Walmart at the very far west end of Bloomington.
There's common ground in downtown.
True. It's not a full grocery store, and it's not really what we're looking for is neighborhood, you know, a neighborhood grocery store where people can walk to the grocery store, and also that carries the kinds of products that are, you know, appropriate for the local community in West Bloomington.
So a full-service grocery store.
Full-service grocery.
There have been a number of grocery stores over the years that have morphed into something else or eventually failed. The Red Fox used to be an IGA, used to be something else, and that eventually went away. There have been things that started out as small grocery stores that ended up as liquor stores before fading out. How can this one be different? How can this effort be different?
Well, we're starting this as a community effort. And so, first of all, to have the full support of the community going into it, to have the support of the city of Bloomington going into it, I think that's going to make a big difference. But also, I want to say that, you know, to everything there is a season. And, you know, some of those efforts were happening at a time when there was an economic downturn in West Bloomington as opposed to, you know, an upswing. And so I think catching this project on the upswing in West Bloomington is also going to make the difference.
What's your process? What are your steps? I mean, it's a long road toward this.
Yes, it is a long road, but we've already been on the road for a little while. Okay. So hopefully we got a few miles under our belt now. Well, here's how it happened. I was involved in one of those prior efforts, you know, as a volunteer that, you know, didn't turn out to go anywhere. And so what I ended up doing in the meantime, I wrote an article, you know, an essay about the history of the food desert in West Bloomington, and I had it published in a professional journal, in a psychosocial studies journal. That's my field. And after it was published, I took it to a bunch of different key people in the community and asked them to read it and meet with me and tell me what they thought. So a number of people read it and they said, listen, this is, you know, if you can get this going, we'll have your support. I'm talking about not in our town. You know, I'm talking about city councilors. I'm talking about community groups. So they said, if you can get this going, great. And so I contacted Arthur Haynes, who is very active in West Bloomington, and asked him if he would read it and sit down and talk to me. We sat down. We ended up having a series of meetings together. And at the end, we said, you know, if the two of us partner up, we can get this done. And we shook hands and we made one pledge. And that is, if we start this, we do not finish until the job is done. So it is a long road, but we spent all of 2018 meeting with all kinds of meetings, meeting with everybody. We spent a long time and are continue to work with the City of Bloomington Economic Development Office. We met on May 30th with Mayor Renner and the director, Melissa Hahn. They're giving us a lot of, you know, input. And one of the things that City of Bloomington had done is have all of the different, you know, grocery store chains come into West Bloomington and take a look to see if they would, you know, locate something there. But what we're facing is what's happening all over the United States, and that is historic districts, poor districts, all end up with a food desert. And none of the chains will come into the food deserts. They can't.
They have too big a footprint. They have too the
right.
Parking.
They need too big a footprint. They need too big of a profit margin to make it worthwhile for them. So what has been happening now is that independent grocery stores, started by community efforts, are starting to open up all over.
So you've got the huge ones and the tiny ones, and not much in between.
Right. What a lot of the stores are like, what are called now like food desert to food swamp, where you end up with a store where there's a lot of soda, a lot of chips, a lot of frozen pizzas, that kind of thing, but no actual
bleached white bread, if that.
Exactly, but no fresh food, you know, no meats, no, you know, no food that people can really call groceries. So we're envisioning it that way. And I think, you know, in terms of its success, hitting it right in terms of what those products are is important in terms of getting the community involvement.
The plaza is too big for the kind of grocery store that you're talking about, so other things will have to go there too.
That's
right. Like what?
We've had six businesses approach us who would like to locate there. Six existing, already successful businesses who would like to open another location in that. So I think in the end, there's going to be a competition.
What kinds of businesses are those, and how would they work together
and
generate synergy?
For example, one is, I'd like to, you know, talk about one is Rencon Yoga Studio. They have a really successful location on the east side. They were accepted into the Chamber of Commerce last year on their first anniversary. They approached us. They would love to put a location in that plaza and be part of the whole project. In addition, they spoke to us about having potentially a program where someone from who lives in West Bloomington could be trained as the studio, you know, manager and yoga teacher for that location. And that's the kind of ideas that we're getting from people. For instance, when we met with MCCA, they were talking about having a, you know, what about young people and workers getting trained there for to work in the grocery industry or in the food industry. We have there's another restaurant, two other restaurants, and an ice cream store that is interested in locating there.
This is Sound Ideas. We're talking with Lori Bell, the project coordinator for the West Market Street Council, about the redevelopment efforts for the plaza at Howard and West Market. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas. What ownership model are you considering for a grocery store and the attendant businesses? They would have their own owners. Would it be in a joint one building kind of thing, or a series of like row houses for this business? What are you envisioning?
Well, I think what we are thinking at this point is that it would be great to have each business be able to own their own site. And that the businesses that have come forward so far have really expressed an interest in that. They would like to own, you know, their own place. So that could be something like a tenants in common or a condo, you know, commercial condominium situation where the grocery store would be one member. As for the grocery store, there is a lot of study and consultation that we are doing right now about how, what should be the ownership model for the grocery store itself. Obviously, we've been looking at the food co-op model, but there's also other models that food deserts are using to open up stores that we are studying. And one of the things that is really key for us is that we really want this to be a locally owned grocery store. And it's really important that people who live in West Bloomington have an ownership stake in that, in whatever way works best.
So what does that look like? If it's not a co-op, how does ownership stake get manifested?
Well, it could be a private owner. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be that one person emerges to be, you know, the owner of the store. But we're very open to looking at different models. You know, it could be not a members co-op, but it could be a workers co-op, for example.
Okay. Do you have a timeline for hoped for redevelopment?
Our first timeline is to buy that property, and we need to buy that property right away before someone else hears this and scoops it out from under us or something else happens. I think, you know, the important thing is to be able to go to an owner who is leaving. I want to say that, you know, in 2009, when the comprehensive plan for West Bloomington revitalization was released, that corner is the heart and soul of that comprehensive plan, redeveloping that actual site, because that site is the gateway of Bloomington. Historically, if you go to the museum, look at all the pictures, that's the gateway. It's the commercial center of West Bloomington. The mural that was just, you know, revealed on Sunday at West Market and Morris is only 20 or 50 yards from the plaza. And so when you come, you know, along Market Street from the west, and you go under the underpass, now there's a wall mural there that's beautiful. But we need to restore that whole, that is the heart and soul of West Bloomington. And so all of the wonderful work that West Bloomington Revitalization Project has been doing to beautify, to put in benches, to create community gardens, all of that work that's been happened over the last 10 years will be enhanced when, you know, the project that's really at the center of it all, you know, comes into play.
That's Lori Bell with the West Market Street Council speaking with WGLT's Charlie Schlenker. At the end of that interview, she talked about the importance of buying that shopping plaza. They now have an agreement to do just that. You can read all about that purchase agreement with the plaza owner, which was announced on Friday, at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas and WGLT Normal today, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock and Charlie Schlenker. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. And we want to know what you think of Sound Ideas, so comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter, we're all at WGLT News. Fit a whole day's worth of WGLT into your morning routine. You can learn more about our daily morning podcast, The Leadoff, at WGLT.org. You can listen to The Leadoff while on your morning jog or making a big pot of coffee, biking to work. Our daily digest of news and calendar items is only 8 minutes long, so you'll finish in plenty of time to get on with your day informed and engaged. Subscribe to WGLT's The Leadoff now on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more at WGLT.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.